the Gathering is quite simply the greatest game ever created. But what makes someone actually sit down and sling spells? For some, it's Magic's complex strategy and intricate gameplay, but for others, and we're willing to bet many more than actually realise it, it's the game's vast lore, its unmatched art design, and the chance to step through the cards and into the multiverse beyond. Welcome to Magic the Flavouring, where we discuss all things magic, flavour, design, and lore. I'm your host, Andy Mann.
And hello, I'm Nathan Cancel.
And if you are listening to us here on the podcast, you're joining us on our inaugural cast, so welcome.
Hype.
Hello, hype, super hype for the first podcast. So Nathan, like, I've been wanting to do this with you for so long. I feel like it's finally time that we put our words immortalized out onto the internet.
Well, exactly. We say enough of them. They might as well be heard by more than just each other.
Just an abundance of absolute garbage coming out of our mouths. We might as well record it and stick it online.
Exactly. It's got to serve some kind of purpose.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been playing Magic now for about, 7 years? 2012 is when Return to Ravnica came out, right?
So, yeah. I taught you just before that. So
yeah, just a little bit before that. So I've known you for about a decade.
Yeah,
and I'd say that our conversations, predominantly, if not exclusively, are about Magic the Gathering, and they're not even just like we might not even be talking about anything to do with Magic, and then somehow it swings back around.
Yeah, we live very diverse lifestyles.
Yeah. We're obviously incredibly busy with our lives that we have so much time to talk about Magic the Gathering.
Mm.
So we're here talking about flavour, everything to do with Magic's lore, flavour and design, as the show catch note is. What is Magic flavour to you?
So Magic flavour is kind of like the thing that brings you in. If you imagine like a game is like a casserole.
A casserole?
A casserole, yeah.
Imagine the game is a casserole.
Yeah.
Right?
One second, I haven't managed.
You've gotten past the first line of the analogy, that's a good start.
Yeah, good, thank you.
So imagine the game is like a casserole.
A casserole. So you need like the ingredients to make up the bulk of it. You know, the meat and the vegetables, the bit that nourishes you, that makes like the stomach happy.
Sure.
You know, the bit that fills you up. But then you can add like all kinds of herbs, you know, spices, mum's secret ingredient, and that make it delicious and make the mouth water as it cooks. Now, if you translate that into a card game, in this case, Magic, you have like the creatures, you know, the 2/2 body. Yeah. The 3 damage burn spell.
Yeah.
You have the pile of cards that you draw from, the area of the game that you discard cards to.
Sure.
You know. But then if you call that pile of cards that you draw from a library and the place that you discard your cards to a graveyard.
Yeah.
And that 3 mana burn spell, that's a lightning bolt. Oh wow.
Sure.
Well that's the flavour, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing that allows it to that elevates the game from like numbers and turn cycles into an expression, a way to represent the game like artistically. And thematically.
Right, it's the feeling. It's the feeling
yeah,
that the
exactly.
game creates.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you got there, because...
Yeah, well, yeah.
You said the word casserole, and I immediately went, what? I have no idea what you're going on
I
for.
I like an extended analogy.
Yeah, sure. No, that is absolutely, isn't it? Like, you hit it on the nail on the head. The area where you draw the cards from is not just your deck. It is a library. The area the cards go into when they are discarded or when they're of no use is the graveyard. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the Magic the Gathering was first created by Rich Garfield and all those guys.
What a man.
Yeah, they're all mathematicians. They're all, like, numbers guys.
Exactly.
And they obviously wanted to create a game which translated better from being just numbers and just stats into something which people could have an emotional attachment with, and also something that people could tell stories with.
Yeah, like something you can identify with, something that allows you to personify yourself. It's like kind of like with D&D, again, or another Wizards product. You get to evoke a certain aspect of your psychology or your personality, get to do it in a way that's interactive, and it's interesting that both those games do it in very different ways, but realistically you do have identities in Magic that you will have affinity to, like certain colours that you might play, certain tribes that you might want to stick to. And so it's quite nice that it gives you a chance to explore that.
Sure. I mean, all these different building blocks. So I think, we're just going straight head first into it then. What if flavour is the expression of the card, if flavour is the thing that is the story of the card that either tells a story or that you can use to tell the story with, the building blocks that make up flavor are something that I think if we ever go on to talk about flavor and lore in specific terms of sets and cards and new releases, you have to understand what the building blocks of all these things are.
There's a lot of things, a lot of different factors.
Sure. The most basic of which, and I think we're just going to breeze through a lot of these, but the most basic of which is the colors of Magic.
So this is like a basic way that the game's mechanically broken down into like factions. And these different factions all express the rules of the game in different
factions. Yeah, absolutely.
So on a base level, white is a community colour. It's all about bolstering each other. Blue's more about intellect, being patient, drawing cards, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Typically. Then you've got red, which is the aggressive colour. It's a bit quick and quite punchy, and it does a lot of direct damage. Black is a colour that tends to generate resources through sacrificing its own, like using a cost to put itself behind to gain advantage.
Sure, decidedly not evil.
No,
black
exactly.
is not evil.
Yeah. There's each colour has a range of good to bad qualities.
Yeah, sure.
And then green is the colour of growth, of expansion, of nature, typically. And these are terminologies that over the years, it's been like, 25
years. Oh, yeah, we're in our 26th year of Magic now.
All of these colours have been explored in various depths, everything from white being an indoctrinated like cult, all the way to...
Sure, white's almost like blind faith or like blind devotion.
And it has a lot of positive aspects of community, but also looks at the bad side of what happens when those become insular.
Absolutely.
In the same way that black characters are a lot of the bad characters because it's a narcissistic colour.
It's a colour that wants to gain things through narcissism and selfishness.
Yeah, exactly. It's a selfish colour, but being selfish isn't inherently a bad thing. No. It just depends on how far you go. Like, a lot of the really, 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 really bad characters in Magic are black, but that's just because that's the colour that typically goes towards an evil overlord is going to be self-invested.
Sure, yeah. No, yeah, that's a really good point.
So the way that the game is broken down into these five colours, they all kind of have, an identifiable play pattern, as well as having an identifiable psychology.
And I think it's worth noting, with all these different kinds of mechanics and all these different ways that the game uses to create flavor, they often directly tie in as well to how the game actually plays as you're playing it as a game. So as you said, those colors break down into factions. They give you an idea of play pattern. They give you an idea of how these colors should be intended to play. Mm-hmm. You're saying about how the colours have changed over time. I think that's very true. If you, however, do want to just kind of get a baseline of what these colours are in terms of the cards that are used, there was a cycle of cards.
Yeah, if you go back in the day to Alpha, there was a cycle of spells that cost one mana of each colour. And it kind of set a base rate for what those colours were expected to be able to do for a single mana. As we go through, you're going to see that's not balanced.
not at all.
there are some that are a little bit stronger than others. So if we go through, white was the only one that was modal. It was the only one that kind of had two modes, and that was that it could prevent 3 damage, or it could gain you 3 life.
And that was called Healing Salve, right?
Healing Salve, indeed. And then you had Ancestral Recall, which was a blue mana to draw 3 cards.
Yeah,
it was target player draws 3 cards.
I hear that's a pretty powerful card.
It's okay. I mean, yeah, it's really good making your opponent draw 3 cards when you have something on the battlefield that deals them a damage. Yeah, it's really powerful. Then the black one was a single black mana to make 3 black mana, add 3 black mana to your mana pool, so a temporary boost to your mana, which was considered very, very strong. Then you have the red, which was 3 damage directly to either a creature or a player, or now these days a planeswalker, so 3 damage to any target. And then the green one was +3/+3 to a creature's power and toughness. And they kind of showed what each colour kind of identifies as doing. So white being the colour that protects, that gains life, blue being the colour that draws cards and gains resources, black being the colour that generated a quick resource. The reason I stumble over that is because that's the one that probably is the least... consistent nowadays.
That's black, gone through black, a lot
black
of changes.
Rituals the ability to generate mana has kind of moved into a different color, and this is something we'll look at in the future as well. And then you had red being the color that wants to deal the direct damage, and then the green color being the color that wants to boost its creatures up.
Sure. And so these are very good baselines to kind of understand how these colors work in terms of the game. And it's also kind of builds rules around what the colors are, right? Yeah. And that is great for storytelling. Stories love rules. Yeah. Stories and flavor love boundaries. Because
restriction breeds restriction, creativity.
Exactly. That is exactly it. And that you can see throughout the entire game. And it's also notable that when cards in certain colors break these rules and break these ideals, that is flavor in itself. Like when you have cards that maybe don't adhere to their color pie identity, that if especially if it's stapled on something like a legendary creature, actually informs the conversation of what that creature means as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, color isn't the only thing that that informs flavor in cards. You have pretty much everything.
Every single thing on the card.
That you can see on a card on the bit of cardboard is inflames it. So you have mechanics, you have card types, you have creature types, you have power and toughness, the names, the flavor text,
its abilities, obviously, and then the art. Did we mention artwork? I think we somehow managed to miss artwork.
Oh, I don't think artwork's very important when you're talking about flavor. No, I don't think that's very important
at all. Just blank. Yeah, don't worry. It's more space for abilities.
Sure, but I mean, we're talking about all these things as if they are on the same level of talking about flavor. If you talk to a lot of Magic players, I think the reason that we feel compelled to talk about flavor in Magic and not just say straight gameplay or not just say straight talking about specific artists or storyline is that the game compounds itself as a whole. So everything informs
each other.
Exactly. You look at a power and toughness of a creature and you might think, oh, okay, so something say is a 6/6 because it's a giant rhinoceros creature.
That makes sense.
As from a mechanics point of view,
whereas if you see a random elf lady that's a 4/7 inexplicably for no reason, because for some they've had to change something in the middle, it doesn't ring true. Everything on the card will feel like it's right when a card is going well, and every single aspect of a card can make a card feel wrong.
Absolutely.
Sometimes you'll just look at a card and be like, I just don't get why.
Yeah, don't get why,
and
that
I don't get why shouldn't be something that you would have inherently if you're playing any normal, you know, non-trading card game, because they all try to lean into this a little bit. But look at poker or something, whatever. You don't question why the six of hearts is hearts. Why is it hearts?
Yeah, because there isn't any flavor to that game, right?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't have the informed quality of the fact that they've set standards by now because they've had such a long time to do so. But they've set fantastic standards by what players' expectations are.
Yeah, sure.
And because there is such a huge storyline to it as well, the cards need to feel ergonomic. They need to make sense.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you look at a case study like, say, Llanowar Elves, one green for a 1/1 elf that taps to make one green.
Yeah.
Then you look at Llanowar Tribe, which came out in Modern Masters. We'll say Modern Masters. If anyone pulls me up on that, it's fine. I'm not going to waste time thinking about it.
It's Ultimate Masters, I think, maybe.
Absolutely not. It's definitely... Oh, no, what am I talking about? It's Modern Horizons.
There we go.
I knew it was a modern something. Fantastic. All right. Anyway, Llanowar Tribe is 3 green for a 3/3 elf that taps to make 3 mana.
And the artwork is the 3 different... imaginings of the card. It's been reprinted multiple times.
Yeah,
it's got
three distinct artworks,
and it's got a representation of each of those artworks.
Absolutely.
In as the tribe. It's so nice.
So everything about it is to do with flavor and the power.
And it's
and
a bit meme-y maybe, but by this point, if you're 26 years into a game, you're gonna be able to self-reference,
sure,
and not make it feel too cheesy.
That's true. But I think the point here is that we're getting at is that I'm sure there are a lot of players, and it kind of depends on what format you're playing. So I'm just going to say straight up here, I think it's very fair to say, you might correct me, you've been playing a lot longer than I have, that we are, first and foremost, we're EDH players, Commander players.
Yeah, yeah.
We do also dabble quite heavily in Limited and Draft.
Yes.
But I would say what we're not is we're not, say, Standard players, we're not modern players.
Yeah, we don't grind, we're not like competitive.
Tournament grinders,
we're not competitive players.
No. And I think there is something about being a competitive player or playing in a format which is more competitive that leads people to believe that flavor isn't as important to you, because certainly it's not as important
it's not the thing that makes you continue to play, but your investment is in achieving the win percentages.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
You want to increase your chances of winning, so you will sacrifice because you need to.
Yeah.
It's like being a runner. You will sacrifice your favorite, most comfortable pair of running shoes for the ones that perform maybe better.
Absolutely.
Because it's better for your time, you know, in the same way that you would take the better cards and put them in your deck and maybe over the cute little makes, you know, I like that card a lot, but I can't play it because it's not as good as the other cards, because I want to win. Like,
But the game is built in such a way that even in these environments, individual cards at least retain their own flavor. Yeah. And especially say if you're playing in standard and you're playing a tribal deck,
yeah.
like obviously things are going to sync up there.
Yeah.
And the game is built in such a way where that helps itself. Yeah.
I guess also the question then is, why did you play the tribal deck? Did you play it just... Because you might not be playing a competitive format, like, say, standard, because you you automatically went online, found what the best deck from the last week was, net deck that took it to the event and tried to tear it down.
Sure.
You might go, okay, like, say, I like playing this particular archetype, and it happens to be that this particular archetype's quite good.
Mm.
So, okay, I get to play this archetype and I get to play competitively. Thankfully, every format has at least some aspect of diversity.
Yeah, sure.
Each deck usually being of a different colour and having a different kind of play style. And those play styles, if they're all competitive and viable, well, you'll naturally tune yourself more towards a certain style, and that in and of itself has a degree of flavour, because the cards will be evocative of that playstyle within it.
Sure.
So even if you're not necessarily in it just for the funsies, for the casual side of it, of playing for the flavour texts,
yeah,
that kind of thing, you still might be informed by the inherent flavour of cards and inherent flavour of sets to be more compelled to play Absolutely. Certain types.
And yeah, I don't want to tell anyone what their experience of Magic is. Because
yeah.
for some people, genuinely, the flavour of the cards really isn't important. But I think the point that we see, and especially coming from a place where we do love the flavour,
yeah.
is that inherently, no matter what you're doing with this card game, flavour is
really important
everywhere, and it is
really
very important to the game. Because
yeah.
it's how the game is built.
Yeah.
The play design teams don't sit down around a table and then throw a dart at a dartboard for each individual
they
card.
They do research. They get a huge amount of data based on what the player base is invested in and likes. And flavor has clearly been a massive push recently. Like, storylines are very, very, very in depth and cared about. And as you were saying, if we're playing as EDH players, we are playing with commanders. We're playing with specific characters that we want to lead the deck.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, there is a competitive side to EDH, but if we're talking for ourselves, we build decks because we like to identify with certain characters and build a deck flavorfully around them that makes every card feel like its own little part of a story.
Yeah.
Its own little part of its own like kind of experience and its own little adventure. And when Absolutely. You sit down with four different commanders, it does feel a little bit like a D&D night, because you will get to do your own thing. There's back and forth. There's alliances made, broken,
Yeah.
There's betrayals. It's nice. And that's going really deep down, obviously, in the way that our format plays.
Sure. But I think that can translate to Magic as a whole. So it's about the choices that you make. So we talk about what creates flavor. What are the things that on a card, on a piece of Magic cardboard that you see that creates the flavor? You quite rightly pointed out that we hadn't even touched on the artwork, and the artwork is a huge point of it. If we look at something like the basic land, something that's in every single set has had, I don't know how many different artworks. I mean, there's at least four or five per set. No matter what kind of Magic you're playing in terms of the format or in terms of the level that you're playing it at, you still have a choice on what lands you pick. Yep. Now, some people obviously don't care, which is fine. But whether you're playing EDH or whether you're playing Limited or whether you're playing... Some people draft with the full arts, for example.
Yeah, some people have that same box of lands that they'll play in every one of their decks, because once you have that favourite set, you never have to buy basic lands again.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe one day someone releases someone that's even nicer. And that's you obviously still tuned into the favour. I think it's impossible not to be. You can't turn it off. You can't be a robot in this game. And it's what's kept the game going so long. If it was just blank pieces of paper which had words written on them, and every card was named like 26B, creature F4, or whatever, then it wouldn't have lasted as long. And I think, especially you look back at some of the artworks back in the day, they're so crazy and weird, and that's the kind of thing that will pull you in to play a card game, especially back then when there wasn't such diversity, and the quality wasn't as good. Like, if you have these really rad, interesting, engaging stories and artworks and card designs, then that's the thing that's going to get the game rolling. And that's essentially what's kept it going for so long.
100%. Yeah, I think it's a good point that you make, that if these cards still had the same information on them, but didn't have the same fantasy IP, no one would be interested. I think I was watching an interview during Amon Kep Standard. It was an interview. I think I could be wrong. I'm pretty sure it was Willie Jensen they were talking to, one of the pro players, and they asked him that very question.
Mm.
They said to him, if you didn't know anything about the lore, which he said he wasn't totally invested in the lore side of things, and they said to him, well, would you still be playing the game if it was, say, a sci-fi setting?
Mm.
And he paused, and he didn't seem like he was too invested in it. Like, people, even subconsciously...
I think maybe that's also because I would actually really love to see a sci-fi set a magic like they spoke about doing a Star Wars crossover.
No,
but I think they'll do it more like they did the My Little Pony and they did the Hasbro one. Like they'll do like a 3-card promo.
Well, they've done Transformers, haven't they?
Yeah, because I could imagine a Darth Vader Planeswalker.
No, don't agree. Don't agree. I mean that kind of bleeds us in nicely to another thing that we can talk about is like what the current sort of meta of flavor is, if you like. I just want to touch on it slightly because Magic has had 26 years now worth of content. And because it is set up to be a multiverse in the story, that's how they get away with doing different planes and it being different sort of settings and fantasy settings. A large chunk of that first, I'd say almost like the first half of Magic, really, was set on a single plane, Dominaria. Yeah. Well, no,
because I think it was a homeland as well. I mean, realistically, most of
it's centered around Dominaria and the characters of Dominaria.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was actually more sci-fi, I think, than people give credit for.
Yeah, we've had like spaceships, we've had laser beams, we've had moon satellites.
Yeah, we've had Phyrexians, which are organic.
You could argue that the Thran
were like the...
Yeah, we've had... It almost is like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah.
It does feel that, yeah, there's some of the... We've had millennia ago extremely prodigious civilizations and that kind of thing. So, yeah. I mean, even if you look... Currently, we haven't touched on the Phyrexians in a while. That's a whole other topic. But the Phyrexians are very much that Borg character.
Yeah, absolutely.
That science fiction, that it is Borg meets Alien, it almost feels like. That kind of compilation of where they want to take over everything, but they do it in a mechanized fashion. Where does the fantasy stop at that point? And where does it become... Like, obviously, there's a thing about, like, no guns in current Magic, because it that feels like that one step too close to reality. But...
You can hear fireworks there in the background.
Oh, it is Halloween, if we're going to timestamp, so... a spooky hello. But yeah, if you look at some of the way that Magic's gone in the past, yeah, it has gone through massive swings of questionable science fiction. But fantasy and science fiction aren't divorced from each other.
No, I think that's fair enough. And as I say, they do have of a multiverse.
Yeah, and we've definitely moved succinctly quite a way away from that. Even when we touch back on the old lore, like it's treated as ancient civilizations, it still feels oldie worldy, even though we've seen essentially like futuristic representations.
Sure, but the reason that they do that, because if the idea of having that one setting and that one storyline arc of the Weatherlight crew and that whole sort of first era of Magic centering around this aesthetic, why then did they make the swing to kind of go to different places and different areas and different verses and different planes of existence? It's to keep people engaged.
Exactly, and it's also to kind of flex once you know the game works as a game.
Yeah.
You can see how far you can push it. You can explore. You're essentially creating new worlds and new ways to play your game in the same. It must be hugely exciting.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
To be able to do this, because you get to generate a film every like 3 months that people get to act in.
Yeah,
like, they
100%.
Get to be in these films, and it's quite nice in that regard that the two do work so hand in hand, because it's the game gets you sucked into the story, or immerses you into the story that you like reading if you are a story kind of person, and if you're not and you're a game person and you like the technical aspect of it, then it kind of gives you this really engaging environment to do it in. Like it's like when you're playing the different things, like say Call of Duty or Halo. Like they're both very, very good first person shooters, but for me, like Halo was that much better because it put me out in this amazing, ridiculous environment.
It took you out into somewhere which you couldn't conceive of ever visiting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of like it gives both sides a really it elevates both sides for each. So it's quite good in that.
Absolutely. So the cards are not the only place where we get our sources of flavor from. It is obviously the main place because it is a card game.
Yeah.
There's obviously a whole lore surrounding the game. And this is something that I hope we tackle in depth, and we will tackle in depth in the future.
Yeah, there's a lot of content.
Absolutely. But the broad strokes of it are you have the card game. There are stories on the cards. There are also many different forms of Magic story, which come in the form of novels, online stories. Mm-hmm. You can pick up from comic books, the IDW series, of which there have been two.
Yeah.
Chandra being the latest one.
Yeah, there are online comics as well.
Yeah.
Like six-page comics, I kind of think.
Absolutely. Which these are all quite traditional forms of media. But Magic has found ways to get story out in other slightly more niche-y ways.
There
are, well, I mean, I'm going to call them board games. I can see on your face. Yeah, you already have issue with that it's classification.
Well, no, I don't. It's just it's not devoid of the card game.
Sure. So the two most recent ones are Heroes of Dominaria and Explorers of Ixalan. Explorers of Ixalan did actually include actual factual magic cards in them with their own set symbol as well. Yeah, exactly.
And they had
cool.
some original artworks for them as well, which was
really nice. Absolutely. But these are attempts to get people playing magic in a way that's different and engaging in a different way from the card game, which is itself informed by the idea that people like playing games for more than just the stats and figures. You know, they wanted to have a different feel to the game. There have also been video games, of which you have a couple of the PlayStation ones, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the name is. I've got the list up. I can't remember.
All these different games and all these different medias have bits of flavor in them, which if you were to just play the card game, you wouldn't necessarily know anything about.
No.
But I think for me, and I can only speak for me, well, I'll pretend I can only speak for me. I really think I can speak for most people. But for now, we'll pretend. For me, all these extra bits of information, when I play a card that's featured in a board game, or when I, say, play a Dak Faden who had his whole own IDW comic book series, I now have all of that backstory that's been crafted to varying degrees of success, but still been crafted by the story design team behind these cards.
Because it is a very, very wide multiverse, and it is an extended universe. So it's not just a simple base, like, okay, everything in isolation. You've now got big, wide story arcs that will span like 10 years. I mean, we essentially got our own endgame last year. There's a kind of parallel which worked really nicely. If you're a geek like myself, and you are, like, I'm a massive Marvel fan. I'm a massive Magic the Gathering fan. In the same year, I got Endgame and I got War of the Spark. If you can get payoff from a set in an isolation, okay, right, you open this really, really cool card and it looks really cool, it does really cool things, and you think, oh, who's that person? Who's that person? And you get 8 years of backstory and you go, oh my God, this guy's really, really cool. And it was my first round, I opened it. On the flip side, if you're the person that's been invested in the story for 8 years and then they finally release a spoiler on a Tuesday and it's that, oh my God, they brought him back. Oh, he's back. And then you get to play with him after all these 8 years. Like, yeah, oh my gosh. Like, you can't have a gravity to cards like that lightly. And you need multiple platforms to do this. And now the story is so depth and the player demand for the story is quite high. And they're very willing to deliver on it. They're putting a lot of investment in making sure that there's identities to their characters. There's compelling storylines that you can invest in. And that the gameplay isn't the only aspect of the game that you can engage with.
Sure, absolutely. Right, I think we're going to move on to talk about the players of Magic the Gathering, the people who actually play the game. Because to understand whether you yourself are someone who you think could actually engage with the flavor of the game or maybe a higher level, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm going to go ahead and assume you are fairly au fait with a lot of stuff Magic the Gathering and probably someone who considers himself to be a bit of a Vorthos. And if you recognize that term, then you probably are one. And we'll get on to what that is in a minute. But if you are someone that's listening to this podcast because you play the game, but you actually want to maybe dip your toes into something a little bit larger, knowing these different kinds of player types, as it were, may help you find a track which you can follow.
Yeah. You also might not realize you're one of these.
Yeah, sure. And these are obviously like broad terms. Yeah, absolutely. These are not necessarily one person is one kind of player. Yeah. Everyone is every kind of player at some point. But yeah, we'll just dive into them. So the first groupings, there are two groupings, essentially. The first one is called psychographic profiles. The other one is aesthetic profiles, which we'll get onto in a minute. Mm-hmm. But psychographic profiles, I think if you are a Magic player, you probably have heard of these terms and probably understand them quite well.
There's even been Magic cards with these names.
There have literally been Magic cards with these terms on.
Magic cards.
So we're gonna bounce through them quite quickly. If you want to get a bit more in depth on them, then Mark Rosewater has done articles on them. I think
there's a load on the Magic Wiki. He's quoted on there quite a bit. He's put a lot of effort into trying to, because he established these roles as well, because he wants to understand how his player base identifies and how he
it's good for marketing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How he can approach them and interact with them.
Absolutely. Cool. So we're gonna bin through them. So first is the Timmy or Tammy. Mm-hmm. Nathan, what's the Timmy or Tammy?
The big Ghost Smash stuff. The big big power play, do the
silly dumb thing.
Yeah, they want to do the big fun thing. They don't necessarily care as much about winning. It's more about, I want to do my big, I want to get my big dumb Leviathan out. I want to play my 8-8 trample. I want to do the big, silly, dumb play.
Yeah, a lot of people who start playing Magic, especially if you picked up like maybe like a starter kit or something, this is probably where you're going to start.
Yeah, because the big giant 7-7 is way more impressive than the 1-1 utility creature.
Oh, like, yeah, absolutely.
You can massively misrepresent typical power when you're early playing, but who doesn't want to?
Sometimes it's not misrepresented.
I still love playing massive, stupid, dumb plays. I mean, you never grow out of that.
It's very satisfying to smash someone in the face for 8 damage with your big trampling elephant. All right, the next one is the Johnny or Jenny.
Okay, so this is the like the brewer, the person, like the mad scientist. They'll try and build an intricate, complicated machine. That of synergy that works together. It's like it's like building a puzzle to them. They want to build a nice complicated puzzle and pull off something impossible.
Yeah.
Again, it's not necessarily all about the winning. They probably care more about if the thing does the thing they want.
No,
it
but
to
it's
do.
if you win in the way that you want it to win. Exactly. That's better than winning just a game just incidentally.
Precisely.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. These guys. I mean, I think EDH players are Timmy's or Johnny's or Tammy's and Jenny's.
Yeah.
For sure, because that is the format of, I mean, they're blended very much.
Battlecruiser Magic, which is kind of how EGH originally started, is all about doing the big power play on power play on power play. Yeah. It's that big building. Like,
setting off the Rube Goldberg machine as well.
Yeah, it's a tank coming at you.
Absolutely, yeah. It's why I play Magic, I'll be very honest with you.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's the interaction.
Yeah. The third one is probably, I'd say it's the most definable one.
Yeah.
It's the most clean cut, and that is the Spike.
Yeah, well, the Spike's typically the person who wants to win. They're the person that will sacrifice flavor and intricacy just for efficiency. They're probably looking, they're typically the grinders, the tournament grinders,
yeah,
the competitive
tournament grinders,
players,
right?
Because you're to better your win percentage, which would be your most important thing. You want to come first each time. You will sacrifice all of the other bits and pieces, as I said earlier. You will define yourself by the fact that your wins are more important than the how you got there.
Sure. Yeah. Although I will say that even spikes do have, this is incredibly
patronizing.
Well,
these are massively generalized.
Yeah, like spikes do have a sense of humor about the magic they play. Yeah. I mean, Autumn Burchett, when they had their Tetramander deck.
Yeah.
All the lands,
all the lands, just a tilt.
All the lands were all different artworks and white border, which is a massive no-no. Like,
yeah, well, exactly. Is that a spike? Is that a spiky flavor play of where you're only doing it to tilt the opponent? There's no like Johnny or Timmy.
I'd say if there's ever a definition for flavor that is spiky, the word tilt is almost definitely the definition for it.
That's a very good point. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, why else would you do it? Even the flavor which Spike uses is used in a competitive manner, just to kind of
exactly. So those are kind of the broad terms, and obviously there's flexibility between these, and most players will at some point go through each. I imagine there are some Johnnies that you'll be more of a Johnny when you brew, you'll be more of a Spike when you play competitively at your FNM, and then you'll be more of a Timmy when you're at home playing kitchen table, just trying something stupid and dumb. Like, you can be all three. It's not always typically environmental, but tend to drift more towards one.
I have 8 commander decks with another 3 on the brew.
Yes.
Every single one of them is going to have a Sol Ring.
Yeah.
That is not a flavor play.
No.
That is a spike play.
Unless you get each one
through.
Altered for each deck, which is, that's commitment, actually. That's real good.
No, but that's definitely something
really
I should do.
Yeah, right.
I did put, I've got all of them are the kind of current, more recognizable artwork of the Sol Ring.
Yeah.
But I do have the older style,
flame wheel one
in my
like,
Grenzo deck.
Yeah, you can get that to be the One Ring. It's
simply because its motif is a red and orange motif, and it's in a mono red Grenzo deck.
Yeah, well, again, that's the aesthetic side.
Yeah. Now you just got me about thinking ways I can alter my Sol Rings.
So talking about aesthetics.
Those are the psychographic profiles, right? So most Magic players will be fairly up on what they are, and they'll have a good grasp of them. The next kind of package of profiles are the aesthetic profiles.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to suggest that people have never heard of them, but I definitely think they're not necessarily as well understood.
No, one of them especially is a little bit harder to define.
Yeah,
it's a lot more, it's been much more recently discovered in the wild.
Yeah, sure. So the two profiles, you have the Mel, which is short for Melanie or Melvin. No one says that, it's Mel. And the Vorthos.
Yeah.
So, Mel and Vorthos, they're seen as being quite distinct. They're both aesthetic profiles because the male, I mean, jump in if I'm talking waffle, but the male is finding beauty in the mechanics of the car.
The way that the intrinsic way the car plays.
Yeah.
So the synergies it will have, if whether it's inter-synergy with itself or the way it works with other cards of a similar type within a set. Just basically, does the card feel like it does what it should do?
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes it might do something really eloquent, and one ability feeds the other one. It's not quite, you've not had it before, and it can really please you because you can see that they've found a new way to take a black and white mechanic and make it feel flavorful, give it some color.
Yeah, you know? Sure. So if I look at a card, say like Krenko. Is it Krenko Mod Boss, which is the original Krenko?
It's the OG
Krenko. Yeah. It taps and creates goblins equal to the amount of goblins you control.
The idea is
so that is a very Melvin-y bit of flavour because it's the mechanic that's informing the story of what's going on.
Yeah, he's building his own little mob.
Right? And he just keeps going around.
Yeah. And if you look at, say, like Trading Post is a really good one.
Oh,
because
yeah.
This is a real, it's one of my favourites.
It's
a Mel's Dream. And the idea is that you have, it's four options. It's four mana artifact, and it has four options. You can either pay one, tap, sacrifice a creature to... Oh, I'm going to jumble this up terribly. Right, so tap what? Pay one, tap, and pay a life to make a 0/1.
Yeah.
You can pay one, tap, sacrifice a creature to return an artifact from your graveyard to your hands. You can pay one, tap, sacrifice an artifact to draw a card, and then one, tap, discard a card to gain four life. And the idea is that each ability feeds into the next, and across essentially four turns and four mana you gain three life. But the idea is that you pay your cost in to get something out, and that's essentially eight different transactions of things, of either losing life, gaining life, discarding cards, drawing cards, sacrificing, returning things from the graveyard. It's a lot of things, and they all form into each other. That is beautiful.
Yeah,
it feels so nice, and it can do so much. And that's what that aesthetically feels really nice.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, that's the Melvin. I think that's a really good way to describe the Mel. And then the Vorthos is, I mean, it's what's visually and lore, but it's pretty much everything else. This is the one which I think we both agree here on the show is somewhat misrepresented the most. So the Vorthos is the person who finds beauty in the lore and the aesthetics of the card from a story point of view.
From the flavor, but as in they don't necessarily care what the card does if it's really pretty.
Sure. So from a Krenko mob boss point of view, so we talked about the tap is the mechanic, which is the Mel. The Vorthos would be more interested in the fact that it's Karl Kapinski did the artwork. There's a Karl Kapinski artwork that it's very evocative of what the character was in their mind. The storyline behind Krenko, if they read the stories and they really loved who Krenko was, they would build a Krenko deck regardless of actually what he did.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, the idea is that these two different profiles, the Mel and the Vorthos, are somehow separate.
Yeah.
And I think that is absolute garbage.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the psychographic profiles. I mean, no one is one way or another.
But I think the difference with the psychographic profiles is that you are generally one or the other
at a specific time.
Points.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I guess.
Whereas
with
the Mel and the Vorthos,
it's a massive, it's a scale.
Yeah.
It's a spectrum.
And then the Mel and the Vorthos, I think, inform each other like so intrinsically that I would
especially
actually.
Especially these days.
Yeah. I think. So these profiles were kind of created very early on in Magic. And I sort of think that nowadays, if someone came up with a suggestion of going, oh, well, someone who likes the mechanics versus someone who likes the lore are different people, I don't think that would be a thing.
Because these days, you can't have them be separate.
Can't have them separate. Everything from the flavor text
independent in any way.
To the artwork to even, like, say, a creature type will match in if it's an interesting card. And
or
if
at least that it should be.
It should be matching in all together.
Yeah, because that's the way that Wizards has kind of really pushed recently. Their design teams have working much more synonymously with each other. They naturally want the card to look. They want the card to look and feel and do correctly.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Excuse the poor syntax, but I mean that's the base thing. They want everything to feel like it works together.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, it's very obvious when it doesn't, and I think over the years they've got very good at picking up on that.
Sure.
I guess the simple thing for a Vorthos is that they would. If a card has a bad artwork, they will naturally not want to play it.
Yeah.
And if you're a lot of your player base are Vorthosians, which now with EDH getting such an increased pool of people, and more players are playing it each year. If you're a Vorthos and you will not go for the ugly artwork, then they're going to stop making ugly artworks.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And they're going to respond to the fact that they know that players like evocative cards.
Yeah.
And so if you're the kind of person that's into that, it's fantastic because they've heard that and it looks like over the next couple of years, they're really going to be pushing to reward you for that.
Yeah, sure.
So it's good for us because it's a lot of stuff to look into and investigate, but it's also great for you guys because it's a great way for you to invest in the game.
Absolutely. But I think there are lots of people that, because these two different ideas of the Vorthos and the Mel still kind of exist as sort of separate things, a lot of people will do very heavily deep dives into the story, but then not necessarily look at the card from a playability standpoint.
Yeah, exactly.
And then many, many more people will look at a card from a playability standpoint. But I've lost count of the amount of times I've been sitting, not necessarily in an EDH setting, but maybe if I'm sat down at a pre-release and we're playing through the cards and I've been keeping up with the stories, or I've been, you know, kind of touching it at least.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I play a card or someone else plays a card that I get really excited about from a flavor point of view.
Yeah.
And they look at me blankly because it's just their turn one, you know, 1-2 flyer.
Yeah, that's their discard outlet, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And
what does it matter?
Yeah, exactly. And I do get a little bit upset by it, I'm not gonna lie.
It's just and that's the thing, because there's so much put into it. It's very easy to have such a complicated game, have aspects of it that are overlooked. But with an increased surge in the story side and that flavour
sure.
integration. I mean, it's something that people will, even without realizing it, be more and more aware and invested in.
Sure. And I think, and at least I believe, and I think you believe, though, that actually these two aspects are pretty much one and the same.
Yeah,
or absolutely. should completely be treated as if they inform one another.
Exactly.
And then that is then the mark
of
a flavorful card and a not flavorful card. Mm-hmm. Is a flavorful card will be successful in merging the Mel and the Vorthos, whereas something that is not very flavorful, and don't get me wrong, not every Magic card needs to be super flavorful.
Yeah.
But if they are not flavorful, that's fine, and they usually can just have pretty artwork.
It's usually when they're directly disparate that it's an issue. Most of the time, a card can be specifically a more mechanical card without any direct, deliberate flavour and feel fine, because it will serve the function. It won't feel wrong to have that 2-1 zombie.
And it's just a generic 2-1 zombie.
Just a generic 2-1 zombie. Fine, cool, fantastic. Or you have the card that's got a huge amount of flavour, but doesn't necessarily... The mechanics of it aren't necessarily super important.
Yeah.
But if you have a card that's kind of representing a certain thing and the mechanics don't feel like that's what it is, then that's when there's a problem.
So I think maybe a big... people might like the card, but I think a big sort of flagship for this, where they're kind of shot for something that's not quite got there, is Ludovic.
From the Commander.
They
could have even swapped him with Crown, because Crown even feels like it kind of does more.
He was meant
Ludovic
to be... He's Necroalchemist.
He was
in a bunch of flavor text on a bunch of blue black.
So he had a lot of people really had such hype to see him, especially when we started realizing that in these Commander products we're going to get random legends from past planes that we didn't get a chance to see because they didn't have enough space in the set to get them all in. But Ludovic was very much one that everyone, like, there's a lot of people out there that really wanted to see him. And when they didn't deliver something that was interesting and evocative, it wasn't even the fact he wasn't good, because he's not terrible, but the fact that he didn't evoke what people expected.
Yeah, didn't connect with that feeling.
It really, really irked people, and it really got under their skin. And it's absolutely, it's completely appreciative. Like, I think, it's true. Like, if you promise a character over years and years and years of little touches of flavor text, and then you deliver something mediocre, that's on you. Like, you've created an expectation, and yes, we're not going to get everything right all the time, but it does feel like the backlash is at least earned a little bit, because you had such a higher expectation.
Sure. So I think we've kind of moved on to our next sort of subject then, quite swiftly, which is, we've discussed what flavour is.
Quite swiftly, that was not swiftly whatsoever.
Oh, yeah, that was 43 minutes of absolute waffle to get here. But there we are. Don't talk to me about waffles, I'm so hungry. So we've spoken about what flavour is. We've spoken about the different ways that people can express flavour, or people can sort of find a path to finding how they like to enjoy the game, if that's through flavour or not. Why should Wizards of the Coast keep up this trend then? If we're saying that in recent times in modern era Magic, they've been focusing a lot on flavour, and they've been doing a really good job at fusing the Vorthos and the Mel as a thing that should be sort of held to a standard, why is it important that they keep on this trend?
Well, I think not only have we hit a certain Again, when I say with a certain expectation, but when you have the story being to have the gravity that it has, and have, especially when now you're pulling a player base in through formats like Arena.
Oh yeah, sure.
You've got so many more people that are investing in the game. You kind of have to deliver a little bit. And other trading card games, like say like Yu-Gi-Oh had its own little series that kind of was able to. I mean, Magic hasn't had one yet. I say yet because
TV show.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
So you kind of it's kind of really important because there are so many people that are scrutinizing the game now, and the gameplay aspect is only going to go up and up and up and up and up. And kind of skirting on its dogtails is going to be the people that the content providers and the content creators that really like that story aspect. And if you don't keep delivering on it now, you've set a precedence for it. It's going to really kind of let the game down because it's got a lot of depth and it's got a lot of opportunity. And it's kind of the way that the company can invest and keep us invested.
Sure. I think it's true that it's about keeping up investment. I think flavor is a really good tool for pushing the game forwards, though.
Yeah.
So you talk about, yeah, the gameplay is going to go keeping going up and up and up. But actually, oh, bless you. Nathan's got a bit of a cold today,
yeah,
guys.
Apologies.
We've got fireworks and sniffles. So it's about pushing forward the game mechanics. So if we look at a card from the most recent set, Throne of Eldraine, we have a look at Gingerbrute, which for my money is one of the better flavor cards in a set full of fantastic flavor cards. I mean, so its stats are, it's one drop, it has haste, and you can pay one, and it gains can't be blocked except by creatures
exactly.
with haste.
You can't catch me, I'm the gingerbread.
Because, yeah, run as fast as you can, you can't catch me, I'm the gingerbread man.
Yeah, and then now, it has the little food.
Oh, yes, and he's, so he's got a food subtype, and you can tap sack him.
Yeah, for 2 mana to gain 3 life. Yeah.
Exactly, so it becomes like a superfood.
He's food, he's a biscuit.
He's a superfood. So these...
gingerbread man, the first superfood.
He's a superfood.
Oh,
he does more than a regular food.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly, thank you. So...
smarter than your average food.
So those... abilities, and this is just one card, but I think this is shown time and time again, the more that they go through sets where they value the idea of flavorful gameplay, is that these effects are very rare on any other cards and are only combined because of the story that the card is trying to tell. Right, you wouldn't find those stats on a not gingerbread man card.
Yeah, that's very much because the set is very much a top-down set, so it takes the idea of the character and then tries to apply mechanics onto it. And the thing that's great about Gingerbrew is that the mechanics tell you what the card is and does, as well as as well as the card having to tell the mechanics. It works so synergistically together. It feels so right.
Yeah, and it feels so much better to play than a turn one mana dork.
Yeah, it's literally no other card in Magic has that line of text on it.
Another aspect of the flavor of a lot of these cards as well is that it actually helps sell the game.
Yeah.
I think this is something which a lot of players actually, because they're already invested in Magic, they don't necessarily see on a larger sort of scale, is that a lot of people, for example, complain about Planeswalkers.
Yeah.
And the conversation about whether Planeswalkers being the focal point of Magic, if whether that should be the case or not, is kind of irrelevant because they need these face characters to sell the game.
Yeah.
And flavor, in a very directly real way, does support the continuation of the game as it is.
Yeah, like even the spikiest of players, even the players that are, you know, so entrenched in the tournament grind that they've kind of forgotten that it was that big kind of that big Timmy moment of the 7/7 that got them invested in the game in the first place. That 6/6 Shivan Dragon that they got, I think actually Shivan Dragon's a 5/5. Sorry. So that big dragon that they opened
in
their first.
Such a scrub.
Oh, God damn. Why didn't we play this game?
Oh, I don't know.
So it's that initial like kind of excitement and pull, and these days like you've got to do that a little bit more. And then because you've got to do that a little bit more from a marketing and advertisement point of view, and you've kind of got to deliver in every other part as well.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think the flavor these days is so successfully done. It's kind of the thing that's kept me playing for so long. Like it's amazing that each set has so much that you can divulge and break down and spend hours of your life obsessing over.
Oh yeah,
not that I do any of that whatsoever.
I mean, yeah, but sure, we haven't spent about 7 hours today talking about this.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's fine. That's natural. It's healthy. Yeah, the fact that there is such a depth to it all is exactly the thing that creates any good game. I think game environment like is the combination of game lore and an environment that you're playing in that feels engaging.
Sure.
And flavor these days, yeah, is actually spot on. They're doing a very, very, very
yeah. I good think job. Magic is in a very good place right now. I know some of the storylines that are being told aren't necessarily everyone's favorites, and we can discuss that further. Talking about Magic lore, design, and flavor moving forwards, we are looking to do many, many different.
Yeah, we're
going to
break
shows.
Down things like everything from like how like even things like card frames, like why they use certain. Text types and stuff
absolutely.
That. Like, a lot of it is technical, but and a lot of it can also be pretty opinionated.
Yeah, sure.
And what we're gonna try and do is obviously like look at where they get it right, where they get it wrong, and then over the years, kind of how they've managed to build this this reputation. Because I feel like Magic does have a reputation.
Yeah, 100%,
over here, obviously
yeah.
we're British, so it's slightly less prevalent compared to America and other countries, but. At the same time, I know a lot of people that play Magic that didn't expect to play Magic.
So oh yeah,
it
sure.
is growing, and the fact that it's moving into multi-platforms means that there's a lot for us to talk about, and a lot of us to discuss with.
Absolutely. So guys, thank you very much for joining us in our inaugural episode. We hope that you stay with us through many, many more hours of talking about all things lore. Like, share and subscribe.
All the good stuff.
All the good stuff on whatever platform you're listening to, whatever they allow you to do, please do it. And thank you very much for listening. This has been Magic the Flavoring.